Forgive our slow start. I'm still in training. It's my second day in training.
He's doing a great job, guys.
Did you sign my waiver? Oh, hang
waiver.
On. Let me get the outline.
So this is Chasing Sound on KOOP HD1 HD3, Hornsby, Austin. We're streaming right now at koop.org, and today's show is called Chasing Tone.
Chasing Tone. This is very clever. I got to apologize to Kanya. I have an episode for next week that's all about murder, and she's not going to be here. She'll be busy with a surgery. I thought I had one more week before she went in for surgery, and I almost had the murder show ready, but we'll tape it for her. So tonight we're going to talk about tone. We're going to specifically focus on the first uses of alternate tones. So originally guitar amplifiers were pretty basic things based on the same principles as old radios. So if your grandparents or great-grandparents had a vacuum tube-based radio, you might have looked at the back of it and seen these glass tubes that sort of lit up when the radio got hot. And if you were super curious, I guess you might have turned a radio station just out of reach to where it was in between two stations and then moved your hand in front of the vacuum tubes and created your own little theremin device. It's a fun little homemade instrument that you can use. So guitar players, at the beginning, it came out of necessity. You would be on the road touring. You couldn't buy new tubes for your amp. So the older worn out tubes would start to distort. Or maybe you couldn't afford a larger amplifier. You were using a smaller one, and you would turn it up past where it was supposed to go. You would crank it to get a bigger sound. And this weird thing started happening. The tones started to distort. They started to clip harmonically. And they create this powerful sustain and this sort of unusual flavor. A lot of people refer to it as like a woman tone. I don't know why they called it that, but it just sort of had this singing sustained to it that people really started to dig. So tonight we're going to get into some interesting uses of tone and some of the first what they call guitar effects. There weren't a lot available in the early days. It was pretty much just the distortion by overdriving the amp, by cranking it up louder than it is supposed to be, or by playing around with the type of tubes that were in it. You could use different tubes, smaller powered tubes for larger amps, and that would sort of force them into this overdriven sound. And then there was tremolo, which is basically turning the volume off and on rapidly. It's very simple, but a lot of people had some fun with that. A lot of early rock and roll and country music used that. We're going to get into compression. We'll go over to the Nashville sound where they were compressing signals using these tube-driven devices that sort of Basically, it takes the lowest part of the signal, boosts it up, and it takes the loudest part of the signal and sort of squashes it down. And that's how they get that weird percussive Nashville sound that we all know and love. And then we'll get into a few other things like reverb, which is the use of springs in a box to create this kind of room echo sound artificially. But we're going to kick it off tonight with Gory Carter. I was trying to find the first recorded use of overdriven tones, but people, you know, they split hairs about where that first started. So we're going to go back to 1951, where Gory Carter did this song called Rock a While. And it's the first song, as far as I could find, that really makes use of this overdriven tone that became very popular in the Chicago blues sound and later sort of became a staple of the whole Chess Records thing with Muddy Waters and all those people. So kicking it off with Gory Carter, this one's called Rock a While. Thank you.
so I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night. Yeah.
That was awesome.
I know, right? All the songs tonight are super short. Hope we don't run out of songs. Probably won't. Usually we have twice as much as we need, but there was a rule back in the day, your song couldn't go to 3 minutes. That's why if you look at Buddy Holly's greatest hits, every song is like 2 minutes and 20 seconds. And so bands in the 60s, when the tide started to turn, these bands would get clever and lie about the time on their songs. So if you look at some old Stones records or old Beatles or Animals or whatever, there would be songs that were 3 minutes and, or whatever, 2 minutes and 83 seconds, just mathematically wrong, and they would sneak it past the radio police. So yeah, back in the day, they just didn't figure teenagers had enough of attention span to go into 4 minute songs. And of course, you know, the 60s and FM radio changed all that. Eventually they were The Who was doing songs that were 10 minutes long. And, you know, think of FM radio back in the day when it was just a pirate band. They were playing whole album sides. They would play like half of Dark Side of the Moon. It was, so there was a big shift. But at the time, focusing on, you know, the first couple of songs of tonight's set list, that was the time where your song needed to be less than 3 minutes, definitely. And if it got close to 3 minutes, you were pushing. It's like, come on, these are teenagers.
Well, I would say commercial radio is kind of not that different today. Like the stuff my daughter
it
listens
is not,
to, for example.
It is not. Yeah, I carpooled with Kanye's daughter to school for like a couple of years, and they just play like the same 20 songs over and over again.
Short.
To where even 13-year-olds are disgusted by it. It's like, come on, Drake has like 6 albums. Why do you only play one Drake song or whatever? You know, these artists have multiple albums. Why do you just play one? I don't know. I don't know how they make the rules. So the second track we played was The Kinks, You Really Got Me. And I know that's not obscure enough for Chasing Sound, but it is super relevant when it comes to the topic of tone. And who came up with the tone for that song? They split hairs about it. So you've got the Davies brothers, who were well known for punching each other in the face. They actually got banned from America in the late 60s. They weren't able to play America for 5 or 10 years because one of the brothers grabbed a cymbal stand and cracked the skull of one of the other brothers. And the government in America was already kind of getting sick of these long-haired British boys, and they were like, you're done. Your visas are revoked. You can't play the States. And they tried to play it off and say that it was avant-garde, that was part of their stage show, that it would be driven to some level of violence and that it was just an accident. They took it too far, and that's why, you know, the other brother had to get 20 stitches or whatever. And it was a bad scene. But these brothers, these guys have been fighting for as long as I've been alive and probably a lot longer. But every time I research the Kinks, you find that these two guys, Ray and Dave Davies, just are at each other's throats, but they're geniuses when they work together. So the tone for that song, You Really Got Me, and that's the for the whole 60s British explosion, where they sort of took American blues and reprocessed it through their own sensibilities and sort of fed it back to us and made it relevant again, relevant for young white teenagers in particular. They used this distortion. So before that song, and that was 1964, the Beatles hadn't really hit a distorted song yet. They did probably 6 months later. And the Stones, they hadn't used the fuzz box on Satisfaction. None of that had happened yet. No one had heard distortion that gnarly, especially not young, you know, white teenagers. If there were probably some black teenagers who had heard some of their parents' records, maybe heard some John Lee Hooker or something, and were a little bit more familiar with it. But most of the population, they had never heard anything so nasty. They were probably reaching for their radios thinking something was broken, right? They just never heard anything like that. So you have to sort of time travel a little bit and see how much of a kick in the gut it was for people to hear that song, You Really Got Me. The way they achieved it was this little green amplifier that was maybe about 5 watts. For whatever reason, it was lime green in color. And the Kinks refer to this amp over and over again, and they used it for years. They would basically take this amp, crank it up past where it was supposed to go. It would distort, and then they would daisy chain it, which was very dangerous. You know, if anyone out there likes playing with amplifiers, don't daisy chain amplifiers together. That's a good way to kill yourself with electricity. But they did that. They daisy chained it into a Vox AC30, which is the legendary amp that most of the Beatles catalog is recorded with. And they sort of used the distortion from this. They nicknamed it the Fart Box or the Green Monster. These were the common nicknames the band had for it. And they would just run it into this giant Vox amplifier, and they got that nasty distorted tone that really turned a lot of heads. It just really changed things. And no one had even considered that you could be that heavy. That song impacted. I know Ozzy Osbourne said he started getting into music because of that song. Jimmy Page from the Yardbirds and Led Zeppelin said that was the song that changed his mind about what guitar was supposed to sound like. So there's, as far as if you like distorted heavy rock, we all owe a huge debt to the Kinks for having the guts to try that. They had recorded a more subdued version of it, and the record company was like, we're fine with this, we're keeping this. And they begged the record company, let us re-record it. But at the time, that just didn't happen. You recorded something once, and there was no way the record company was going to pay to record it again. So finally, their management company paid for it themselves. They upped the money, and they did a secret session. They booked a recording studio at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was a huge deal. Like, bands could be cut from their contract for doing something like recording a song again. This, you know, this was back when albums were knocked out in 8 hours. Like, you just brought the band in, everybody plugged in at once, you put up these partition walls to sort of separate the sound, and you just knocked it out. You know, there's classic albums that were done in 1 or 2 days like this. So they recorded it again in spite of all the odds, and that's how we got that song that changed the sort of psychic landscape of American teenagers forever. So we're going to move away from the rock and roll for a minute here and jump over to the other side of the pond, which is Nashville. And you had some of the legendary guitar players of the time, like Chet Atkins, Merle Travis, and they were impacting this new breed of sort of outlaw country guys. Probably one of the more interesting ones would be Jerry Reed. You may know him from the film Smokey and the Bandit. I know I was a huge fan of that. Whenever I was a little kid and I would stay home from school sick, my mom would go rent me several of the Smokey and the Bandit movies. I don't know why. I always loved watching those when I had a fever. So instead of using these sort of distorted, overdriven tones, they were digging something called compression. Now, nowadays, guitar players just get a little box that's about the size of like a pack of cigarettes, and you plug that into your guitar and into your amp, and that will sort of squash the tone. But back then, compressors were the size of like a toaster oven, and the knobs were as big as apples. They were just huge, huge things that only the studio producers would ever get their hands on. And these artists started getting into the idea of just turning the knobs way farther than they were supposed to be to squash the tone and get this weird percussive sound. It's hard to describe, but you'll hear it right away when we start this track. So there's a dynamic range when you plug a guitar into an amplifier. You strike a note, and it has the low and the high. And compression basically takes the quietest parts of the note and boosts it up, and it takes the loudest parts of the note and squashes it down. And what you get is this sort of medium, very, very percussive. That's how people like to describe it. It sort of turns the guitar into a drum in a weird way. So we're going to play this song, Amos Moses, which is about a guy who had his arm bitten off by an alligator because his father used him as alligator bait when he was young, but he grew up to be a famous alligator hunter. It's probably the weirdest story you've ever heard. I can't even do it justice. It's a very weird song, but in its day, it was a huge hit. So remember, I'm still in training, so give me a couple seconds to fire this up. After a man of the cloth, called him Amos Moses. I love that song. Just the chorus is so weird. They raised up a boy who could eat up his weight in groceries. How is that a hit? But that was a huge hit. It's so funny to think just how bizarre that was and how hard it would be for that to be a hit now. Love that song. If I could get away with it, I would play it like 3 times in a row right now till everyone else loves it as much as I do. All right, let me turn that thing off. Okay, next thing we're going to get into is tremolo. I'm trying to make this episode not overly academic, but I do want to give some basic understanding. So just, you know, not everybody out there is a guitar player, and it's really not important either. In fact, these effects have more impact on your soul. And you know what I mean. When you're a kid in high school and you play your favorite rock record after your parents just yelled at you for doing something stupid, which you didn't perceive as stupid at all, and you go to your room and you put on those headphones and everything that you want to say to your parents but have no idea how to articulate, suddenly your favorite artist is saying it perfectly well through a song, you know, whether it be the Sex Pistols or Aerosmith or whatever you're into, it somehow articulates everything you wish you knew how to say, the things that you can't intellectualize, but you feel instinctually very well. And yeah, so these effects, they just move you the way Pink Floyd uses what's called time-based effects, where it sort of grabs a note and then it repeats the note a little quieter each time and a little darker each time and sort of fades into this spacey wash. It gets you emotionally, and understanding the academic side of it is almost a handicap. The more you understand the magic behind the machines, the more it makes it, you know, like understanding your math homework or something. It makes it a little bit less magic and you have to work a little harder. Yeah, I think that's why so many musicians drink or get into vice, is because you have to sort of forget all the things you've learned and reconnect with the magic of it. So tremolo is one of my favorite effects. If I had a list of three different guitar effects or music effects, tremolo would be right up there. It was one of the first. No sooner did they have guitar amplifiers than within maybe 10 or 15 years, they started building effects into them, because no one had stomp box effects or pedal effects back then. So manufacturers like Gibson, Valco, Fender, these amp companies would just build a couple of effects into the amp to help out touring musicians to achieve the sounds that they were pulling off on their records, but do it in a live format. And one of the first effects they included besides reverb was tremolo, and that's where it takes the signal and cuts it off and on. Not to be confused with vibrato, which was a very popular amplifier effect. So basically tremolo takes the signal, drops it out, and brings it back really quickly, and you can sort of adjust the intensity level of the throb, and you can also adjust the speed of the throb. You can make it off and on really fast, or you can make it really slow. Think like Portishead for really slow throbbing tremolo. Vibrato more affects the pitch. It sort of creates a different pitch that bounces off the initial tone that you just made. And it's same thing, that song Rumble, you know, dan, 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 the instrumental song. I'm sure everyone's heard it.
Yeah.
The song Rumble is a good example of vibrato. But we're going to play a couple of tracks that highlight tremolo tonight. And to give you an understanding of what it took to put tremolo in amplifiers back in the day, the early tremolo involved an actual motor that shook a canister containing hydraulic fluid.
Wow.
It's so bizarre. Actually, some of the first delay effects were like this. There would be a small disc, like a record, inside of a tube full of hydraulic fluid, and the disc would have like a little diamond blade or something that when you would play a note, it would cut it into the disc like a record and then play it back. And it sort of stayed static by this fluid that was inside of it. Insane to think about this stuff. Like, nobody would ever, if that was the only way you could get that sound now, nobody would bother. It's too much work. But this fluid would sort of oscillate in this canister. And they called it all kinds of things, electrolytic fluid or whatever. There were rumors that it was actually kerosene inside there. And some old blues guys wouldn't use it. It was like, man, that thing's full of kerosene. It's going to blow up the whole club. But it really was just a type of hydrofluid, and it would sort of shake around and bring the signal in and out without damaging the amplifier. And there's something about tremolo that really tells a story. If there's just a guy and a guitar singing to you, and you want to be taken to some place, you just want to be in the middle of some dark country road and really just in it, in the moment with the singer, tremolo is the effect you almost have to use. It's the one that instantly tells you a story and puts you in a place. So we're going to play a couple of tracks to really highlight good use of this. We're going to do a Creedence Clearwater Revival song, and then we're going to follow up with a John Lennon solo song off of his first album he did after the Beatles split up. So starting off, though, is going to be Midnight Special by Creedence, and this is off their Willie and the Po' Boys album.
And then we're going to roll into some announcements right after.
Well, you wake up in the morning. You hear the work bell ring. And I march you to the table. You see the same old thing. Ain't no food upon the table. There's no fork up in the pan. But you better not complain, boy. You get in trouble with the man.
Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me.
to see the governor. She want to free her man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special
Radio in partnership with Rio Rita brings you the first ever co-op DJ night on Thursday, July 12th. It's a night of fun and great music from 7 to 12 p.m. featuring some of your favorite Saturday DJs spinning live sets, including Jay Robillard of The Lounge Show, Dennis Compa of Adventures in Sound, Amy Frischke of Fresh from the Underground, and Scott Gardner of Stronger Than Dirt. Rio Rita is located at 1203 Chacon Street. More information at coop.org.
Support for Co-op comes from the Austin Chronicle's 5-8 Brew Tour, July 13th through 15th. a self-guided craft beer lover's tour of North Austin's breweries, including Fourth Tap Brewing Co-op, Adelbert's Brewery, Austin Homebrew Supply, and more. Tickets available at austinchronicle.com/brewtour.
All right. Thanks for those breaks. Once again, you're listening to us at KOOP.org. KOOP, HD1, HD3, Hornsby.
Yeah, legal ID. Way to go, Kirk.
Thanks. It's the first time I ever remembered that. You're hanging out here with Kanye and I, and our friend who's hanging out with us tonight, he mentioned the whole speaker cutting thing. So for those of you who've listened to the show from the top, we played The Kinks, You Really Got Me. And I forgot to mention, even though it's on my outline, which I seem to never be able to follow, if you listen to Dave Davies, both brothers Ray and Dave Davies individually take credit for the sound, but if you listen to Dave Davies, who is, wink, wink, probably most likely the guy that came up with it, he actually cut, or according to him, he used a razor blade to cut the cone on the speaker on this small green amplifier, and that's what caused the amp to distort in that really rich, kind of buttery way that was so unique and different from other uses of distortion at the time, of which there were very few. So we just had a couple of tracks to highlight the use of tremolo. Of course, Midnight Special by Creedence. You can't go wrong with that. One of the darkest sounding songs of the 70s. I love that song. And the first time I heard it was that, do you guys remember that cheesy 80s Twilight Zone movie?
Yeah.
With, you know, it had all the famous directors.
The little girl's lips went away, remember?
Yeah, the Landau and Steven Spielberg directed one.
It was so terrible.
It was so bad. But they got like five directors, the top shelf directors of the 80s, and had each of them direct a little Twilight Zone episode, and it was sort of an homage to the show. But the first one of the movie, of these two guys that are on a road trip driving at night, and they're trying to creep each other out. So, you know, one of them will turn off the headlights and the dome light in the car, and it's just pitch black, and they're just scaring each other. And at one point, they're flipping through the radio, old 80s radio, where they're turning the dial, and they land on Midnight Special, and the guy driving is like, oh man, this is my song. And they get into it, and they start singing it to each other. And then at one point, the passenger is like, you want to see something really scary? And he turns away for a second, and then he turns back, and he's like a werewolf or something crazy. It's really cheesy. But the part I remember the most was the Creedence song.
I saw that movie in the theater, man.
No way. Yeah, did you
such
really?
Such a waste of a theater ticket.
My family and I went and got the VHS at our local video rental, Woods Video in Beaumont, Texas, which has been out of business a long time. And remember when that was an exciting thing?
A video store?
Going to the video store?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was so, I always got so stoked going to the video rental place. That was always like a payday activity.
It's like a candy store for like a
teenager. Yeah, mom gets paid. It's like, all right, we're getting pizza and we're renting movies. And then that was it. After that, the paycheck was gone. you had to wait 2 weeks to do that again. So tremolo, after the Creedence song we did, Hold On by John Lennon, and right after the Beatles broke up, most of them couldn't let go of Ringo. So if you listen to early Paul McCartney solo stuff, early John Lennon solo stuff, pretty much all of them would still get Ringo to play drums on their solo stuff, because it's weird. All of them sort of later confessed in interviews that they just didn't know if they would be any good. And there was this fear that if you took them out of the situation where they only really had to come up with, you know, if you're George, you had to write two killer songs per album. If you were John and Paul, you had to write four, but you certainly didn't have to write 10 or 12.
Right.
And they didn't know if they could be that good. And John Lennon was very shy about his guitar playing. All these weird things that, you know, we didn't really know. When you're looking at the Beatles, you just see this perfection, if you're into them. You see this perfect band that's making killer album after killer album. But when you pulled them apart, they struggled. All of them individually really struggled, except Ringo, funny enough, the guy that contributed the least songs.
He played on all their albums.
That guy was so carefree. He's like, no, I'm awesome wherever I go. That guy never had a doubt about his skills. because he was such a good drummer. I mean, there was always work. If you want Ringo to play, and this is true, if you want Ringo to play tambourine on one song on your album, it's like $25,000 an hour. And people do it. Like, people wait in line to get Ringo to play tambourine on a song. He's that good. So, yeah, that song was off Plastic Ono Band, which was the first John Lennon effort after the Beatles broke up. So it goes from Abbey Road to the Beatles breakup. They released Let It Be after that, but Let It Be had been, of course, recorded before Abbey Road. They didn't release it because they didn't like it. So it was sort of a posthumous breakup release. But chronologically, it was Abbey Road and then the breakup. And John Lennon came up with this album. He got this German bass player. He got Ringo on drums. And he sort of did all the other instruments himself. And it's really interesting. The texture of Plastic Ono Band is three instruments and a vocal. So it would either be bass, drums, and piano. And when there was piano, there was no guitar. Or it would be bass, drums, and guitar. Never extra. It sort of reminds me of the White Stripes. They had that sort of three-tone sound where you never overdid it. If there was going to be organ on a song, then there's no guitar. It gives this sort of feel that's really emotional. And for my taste, Plastic Ono Band was the best thing John Lennon ever did outside of the Beatles. There isn't a bad song on it. Some of the songs you may have heard is like Mother, that really emotional ballad about losing his mother, which is just, if you've had mother issues, so that good. Is the most gut-wrenching song, right?
Yeah.
And it's got Working Class Hero, probably the first song on a major label record to include the F word. It was kind of a big deal at the time. But the song we played, Hold On, is of course another love song about Yoko, but it uses that tremolo guitar, this sparse, shimmery tremolo that's just so pretty and so melodic and perfect. So the next effect we're going to get into is fuzz. Now, fuzz started appearing in music right around, like, maybe earliest would be 1959, 1960. And it was interesting. A lot of these inventions aren't initially made for what they ultimately get used for. So the first, think of the wah-wah pedal, like Jimi Hendrix, the waka-waka pedal. The inventors of that thought it would be great for horn players.
Oh.
And they marketed it to horn players. In fact, the first person to do an endorsement for it was this wannabe Chet Baker trumpet player. He was like, yeah, I'll endorse your waka-waka pedal, you know.
But don't horns already naturally make that sound?
Yes, right?
Okay.
That's what makes it extra dumb. But if you can go on the internet now and see these old adverts for, like, you know, make your horn come to life with this waka pedal. But eventually, of course, horn players bought them and quickly pawned them. And then guitar players started going to pawn shops and buying them. And there's all these great stories of, like, the first session guitar players that brought it to a session and how everyone else in the band would just look at them like, you need to turn that stupid thing off. That thing is annoying me to death. Because they would play a rhythm like, wow, wow, wow. And then eventually all these age, you know, seasoned session guys would look at them like, that thing is stupid. You need to turn it off, kid. You need to get out of here with that stupid waka waka pedal. But eventually it got into the right hands, and, you know, Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix changed the world with that thing. And fuzz had a similar path. So the fuzz pedal at first was marketed, and you got to remember, this is before the 60s, Summer of Love, big rock, Marshall amplifiers, but fuzz pedals existed. Gibson made one called the Maestro. I think it was in production as early as 1961. That's before the Beatles were putting out records.
Wow.
And they marketed it as this: make your guitar or bass sound like a bassoon,
oh.
Right? Because who doesn't need that in their life? I want my guitar or bass to sound like an oboe or a bassoon.
Right.
And in Nashville and in Los Angeles and New York, where basically all the records were made in those days, session players started bringing it in little by little. I think the first single that featured it, do you remember on that, the Spoon album before last, that song, You Just Don't Understand, Will You Say That You Love
Yes.
Me? That's a cover of this female artist. And that song came out, I think, in like 1961, but it featured one of the first fuzz guitars. And that's how they were using it at first. When it would come to a guitar break, they would put on the fuzz pedal, and it just gave it an edge. So the same way as, you know, fast forward 4 or 5 years to the Stones' Satisfaction. not that many people had heard the fuzz. So when you hear Satisfaction, dan, 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 but it sounds like a bumblebee inside a tin can.
Yeah.
It just grabs your attention. You're like, what is happening? Like, what in the world is that sound? And so little by little, fuzz sort of gained acceptance. They stopped marketing it as a way to turn your guitar into a bassoon, which was, you know, ridiculous. And these geniuses, guys like Keith Richards, started getting their hands on it, and it became one of those effects that's one of the most important. Think of Jimi Hendrix. He used the famous Fox Tone Machine, one of the first fuzz pedals that actually created a natural analog octave up sound. So think of the solo in Purple Haze, where suddenly the guitar just sounds like something coming out of Superman, where you're just like, how does that sound so impossible right there? That is the sound of a fuzz pedal producing a natural octave up, where the guitar gets brighter than it should be and way fuzzier than it definitely should be. So an early example that I found within my own catalog of songs without having to go out and buy a song for this was the Beatles on the album Rubber Soul, which I think was recorded maybe end of 65, early 66. They got their hands on a fuzz pedal. I think Vox had made one, and Vox gave the Beatles all the gear they wanted, basically. They had a deal when the Beatles first started. Their manager convinced Vox, if you buy this band all their amps, we'll endorse you forever, basically. So you'll never see a picture of the Beatles playing without Vox amplifiers and effects. So the company Vox came up with a fuzz pedal. The Beatles got their hands on it, and the first one brave enough to use it was Paul McCartney. For this George Harrison song called Think for Yourself, he plugged this fuzz pedal into his bass, and you'll hear it right away. The bass sounds like a bumblebee. It's just really unique, really interesting stuff. So we're going to play a couple of songs. This is sort of ending the academic portion of the show. We're just going to have fun from here on, but we're going to kick off the fuzz section with Think for Yourself by the Beatles. God, right?
Great stuff.
The band Fuzz, of course. I actually know what pedal they use, too. So that is Ty Segall's band, one of the few bands he's in where he isn't the main singer. He's actually the drummer in that band. That is a trio, and on their guitar effects boards, they only have one pedal. They have a tuner, and then they have this pedal called Fuzz War by a company called Death by Audio, and it is probably the fuzziest thing you've ever heard in your life. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know if I'm right about this, but I'll bet that company mailed one to Ty Segall and said, check this out. And he probably started that band Fuzz and named it just to go on the road and play that pedal.
You're just making that up?
No, I don't know if that happened that way, but all the evidence points to that. And not just the guitar player. So it's a three-piece band. You've got a drummer, Ty Segall, doing the drums, and you've got a bass player and then a guitar player who does the singing. And they both use it. So both the bass player and guitar player are just playing this one pedal cranked up into these massive amplifiers. And it's, yeah, Death by Audio, this fuzz pedal. It's unbelievable. Probably the fuzziest thing I've ever heard. And it has a lot of girth to it, too. It's got a lot of bottom, unlike the classic 60s fuzz, which was pretty much all high-end. So I'm looking at the songs we have left. We can't play them all, but timing-wise, I don't know. What do you think?
Funkadelic.
You want to do the Funkadelic?
Yeah.
Let's just do it. If we're going to do that, we need to do it so we can have time for our announcements at the end. So thanks for listening to Chasing Sound. We really appreciate it.
Thanks to Steve for coming in and hanging out.
Yeah, hanging out. We had a really good time tonight doing the Tone episode. Next week is going to be all about murder. We're going to be doing murder ballads and some interesting dialogue components. So stay tuned for that if you're into murder as a topic, not as an activity, of course. So here we go. We're going to close out with Funkadelic from their album Standing on the Verge of Getting It On. This is I'll Stay, and it features the wah pedal.
Wah, wah, wah. And I won't be here for like 4 months. No, 4 weeks.
4 weeks.
Mother says, son.